Support for WPR comes from Viterbo University, offering online bachelor completion programs, including business, education, nursing, and more. Information is available at viterbo.edu/completion.
Support for WPR comes from Present Music, performing honest music with guest violist and curator Nadia Sirota, May 9th at 8 at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Tickets and info are at presentmusic.org.
It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farad. Coming up later in the program, we'll talk to a guest who spent 34 years as an attorney with the CIA. He worked on a lot of controversial issues, including enhanced interrogation techniques, including waterboarding.
First, we take a look at some cool new gadgets and technology services that were announced this week. Today is the last day of the Consumer Electronics Show, or CES, the biggest trade show in the industry. It's possibly the biggest week of the year for gadget lovers.
Techies descended on Las Vegas to get their hands on smart watches, smart TVs, smart everything, really. But which products are here to stay? Which will just be flashes in the pan? Joining us now is Omar Gayaga. He's technology culture reporter at the Austin American-Statesman. Omar, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, what I've been reading, it looks like the big buzzword in this show is wearables, wearable technology. Can you explain that?
Yeah, it seems like every company this year has a smart fitness wristband they want you to wear through the rest of the year. Wearables covers everything from, you know, fitness wristbands, like the ones that have become popular from Fitbit and Nike. But it's also includes smartwatches, which Samsung has tried and not quite gotten yet. It could include things that like Google Glass that you wear on your face. So, all of that is what wearables is. But really the hot category, I think, this year and over the holidays, in fact, in shopping, was the fitness wristbands. I think that those have become pretty mainstream, and there were a ton of those at CES.
I haven't looked at one or tried one myself. What do these fitness wristbands do?
I just bought one last week, so I'm actually...
And so you're really fit now. You're in great shape.
No, not at all. It's not worked as I would like.
Take it back.
Yeah, and I've tested these before. I tested the Nike Fuel Band last year and one from a couple of others. And, you know, what they do generally is they're like souped-up pedometers. They measure your steps. They can tell whether you're going up and down stairs. They can measure your calorie count of how much calories you're burning. So really, that's sort of the start of what these things can do. But the ones that we're seeing now can also connect to your smartphone wirelessly. So as you're doing all this activity, it can send that information to your smartphone. You can look at it on your phone and, you know, track that data over a long period of time, see how you're doing each day, and, you know, get into a routine of doing that. So that's sort of the start of what these can do. In the, you know, near future, we'll see them start to do more things with your smartphone. We'll see ones that have better displays and can give you more information on the actual wristband. So we're really right at the start of this, but they are starting to get pretty popular among fitness geeks, at least.
Staying on the wrist, you mentioned smart watches. Where is that technology? Are we getting close to something that everybody's going to be wearing in the next year?
You know,
not quite.
Probably not this year. Samsung, like I said, they had a product called the Samsung Gear last year, and it really didn't do very well, and it was pretty clunky. It got not very good reviews. And really what everybody's waiting on is Apple going to introduce something like that, you know, that maybe has better software and is a little bit more elegant. And the Samsung one is a little bit bulky. It's trying to do, you know, a screen on your wrist and trying to give you messages and email and all that. And, people are wondering, you know, is there a simpler, more elegant way to do that? Something that's somewhere between a smartphone and a watch, but without the bulk and without the complexity. So, there were a lot of those also at CES, but nothing really that stood out as killer. There are some devices like one from Razer that's trying to kind of combine the fitness wristband idea with the smartwatch idea. But I don't think anyone's seen anything that is the one that people have been waiting for.
Also in the wearables category, Google Glass has been out in the streets being tested for a while now. They're not alone in the eyewear department. What other sorts of things are coming along to try to compete with Google Glass?
Yeah, I think you saw there were a lot of knockoffs of Google Glass at CES, a lot of things that look pretty ugly, as a matter of fact, a lot bulkier, but also ones that are trying to do different things than Google Glass. I mean, Google Glass is trying to be about photos and shooting video and kind of very unobtrusive notifications, but there are some that are straight up, you know, recording devices or straight up more internet-connected style devices. So there were a lot of things that were like Google Glass, but not quite, or trying to take it in a different direction. I mean, one of the most interesting things that I read about was from Oculus Rift, the new version of their virtual reality headset, which is not really like Google Glass in the sense of wearing it all the time. But for gamers, it's a huge deal. It could be the next generation of video games. It's something that puts you in a 3D space and is very light and easy to wear. I mean, game developers are really excited about that. And the version they showed at CES got a lot of raves.
Are we consumers secretly clamoring for more technology that we can wear, or are they filling a niche that doesn't exist here?
I think when people see a practical application for it, like the fitness bands, I mean, that's something you can really grasp. You know, it's something, you know, if I'm going to go running, if I'm going to go to the gym, it's going to keep track of these things, and then I'll have that data to use later. That's a very simple concept. But when you get into things that are trying to do, you know, things where you're checking your email with your watch, or you're trying to do, you know, have a conversation with Google Glass, I think the added complexity kind of turns people off. And with Google Glass, you have a whole other issue with privacy and the whole idea of if you go out wearing these, some people are going to avoid you. I mean, there's definitely a bit of a backlash with Google Glass. And this is the year that Google is supposed to bring this to retail. So far, it's cost $1,500 and is only available to people with invites. But you know, even if they bring it down to like $1,000, I mean, I don't know a lot of people that are going to pay that much money for something that's going to make them a social pariah. So I worry about Google Glass a little bit.
Moving to other categories, a lot of TVs at the consumer fair, the CES. Some of them bigger than my house, it looks like. What's the state of the art in TVs being released at the event?
Yeah, in past years, I mean, we really haven't seen anything that's been as drastic as the shift from SD to high definition. What they've tried to do the last couple of years, TV manufacturers, is things like 3D television, which never really caught on. It's become a bit of a standard feature, but it never really got the excitement that HD did when it debuted. So what you're seeing now is 4K or ultra television. Those are both the same thing. And really, that's just a higher resolution version of HD. Those are very expensive right now, but the prices are coming down very quickly. And the other thing you see this year is more smart TVs, which is basically just internet functionality, things like Netflix and Hulu, but also ways to use Twitter and Skype with your television. So you've seen a lot of interfaces of televisions trying to do that. And the thing I thought was most interesting was that Roku, who makes those little boxes that let you access Netflix and other online services, is introducing their own television, a Roku-branded TV set later this year. Now, that's something that Apple has been rumored to be doing for a couple of years now. And since the Roku one won't debut till the fall, you know, you never know. Apple might kind of get in there and put their own out there. So there's still a lot of uncertainty in television. I think 4K and Ultra is definitely not ready for prime time. There's just not a lot of content that you can get in those resolutions yet, you know, from your cable provider or on disk. You know, it's just not there yet. And also, who's going to download something that takes four or five times longer than an HD movie does now? Bandwidth is another big issue with that. So yeah, there's a lot of new TV products. Curved displays was another thing at CES this year, but you're still in the realm of, you know, are people going to really buy those this year? Probably not. It's probably still about another 18 months away before they get affordable.
You mentioned the smart TVs. There's been talk of a lot of other smart appliances, a refrigerator that knows when we're low on milk and notifies us, or maybe orders a drone delivery. I don't know. Are we seeing at this show a lot of smart appliances of that sort in the early stages?
Yeah, the smart refrigerator, that's one I've had my doubts about for a long time. Never seems to happen, does it? No, internet-connected appliances were a big deal at the festival, and things like connected crock pots and toothbrushes, which, you know, if you're into that. This is part of a larger movement called the Internet of Things.
Toothbrushes?
Which is basically,
really?
Yeah, internet-connected toothbrushes.
The Internet of Things. Go on.
Yeah, the Internet. When you want to know when your kids are brushing and look at it online and be able to see what nights your kids didn't brush enough. The Internet of Things is basically everything internet-connected, all of your home appliances, everything talking to each other. And, is this something consumers really want or need? Maybe not so much, but there are some interesting ideas. There are some instances where you could see, you know, a smart refrigerator downloading recipes for you, or like you said, you know, telling you what's in your fridge, and here's some things, you know, some suggestions on what to do with those items. So there's great ideas. You know, are these things you're going to go out and buy this year? Probably not.
That smart toothbrush may be hard to top, but can you leave us with maybe one of the wackiest things you've seen or heard about at the event?
Oh boy, there were some a lot of Russian doll monitoring system that was kind of interesting and really cool looking. Actually, you know, one thing I think is really interesting is that Microsoft is sort of in a weird position this year because Intel made a big push for dual boot devices, which are devices that, you know, like tablets that can run Windows and Android. So, you know, less reliance on Windows and Microsoft as a whole, more flexible devices that can do multiple things. You also had Steam machines, which are PC gaming devices that are sort of a mix between console and PC machines, specifically for gaming. So there was a lot of cool stuff at CES this year. Only a fraction of it is stuff that I think will actually end up in homes, you know, within the next 6 to 9 months. But a lot out there. And, you know, this is really the big push in January that consumer tech manufacturers make to say that we're staking our ground. This is what we're going to come out with this year. But it's stuff you may not see till October, November.
Omar, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Of course. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Omar Gayaga is technology culture reporter at the Austin American Statesman. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
I'm Veronica Rickert. Later in the hour, we'll round up this week's state news with our assistant news director.
Now, though, in the wake of September 11th, the role of the Central Intelligence Agency evolved. Once dedicated to collecting information around the world, the CIA began tracking down suspected terrorists and extracting information from them.
In the process, the CIA began to use what are called enhanced interrogation techniques, including waterboarding. From the moment the public knew about these techniques, their legality was debated at home and around the world.
When the CIA turned to these methods, it had to assess the legality of the techniques. The man they turned to was John Rizzo, who spent 34 years as a lawyer in the CIA, 7 years as chief legal advisor there. John has recently published a book about his time at the CIA called Company Man, 30 Years of Controversy and Crisis in the CIA. John, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for inviting me, Rob.
Well, tracking down terrorists in the wake of September 11th, there are a lot of agencies that have been involved in that, the armed forces. What's the particular role that the CIA has played?
Well, the CIA, among other responsibilities, is the instrument of the White House, of the president, to conduct covert action programs. And that includes both tracking and, in the case of the post-9/11 era, capturing, detaining, and interrogating in secret high-level members of Al-Qaeda. So that was the role the CIA was given and the one we undertook.
Well, as a legal advisor at the CIA, what does a CIA legal advisor do? What role do you play in those operations?
Yeah, I realize one of the reasons I wrote this book, Rob, is that people, I suppose, generally don't associate CIA with lawyers. But the fact of the matter is that CIA was and is heavily invested in lawyers, has many lawyers that they're woven to the fabric of the agency, and particularly so in the 9/11 era. And since during that time I had risen to the role of a chief legal advisor, I was the point man, so to speak, for all of the legal questions arising out of the war of terror, war on terror post 9/11, and the methods by which CIA were to combat it.
And that's kind of how you got the gig in the CIA in the first place. You were watching the Church Committee hearings on the role of American intelligence, new rules being implemented, and you basically said, these guys need some more lawyers, right?
Yeah, I mean... You know, my decision to apply to the CIA way back in the mid-70s came as a result of the Church Committee revelations and hearings, which I watched on television like many Americans. And, you know, at that point, I knew I was in my, you know, mid to late 20s, knew nothing about the CIA, but it did occur to me that if CIA had lawyers, which I didn't really know at the time, but I also concluded that if they didn't, they were going to need some. And so it was a leap of faith on my part. I really knew no one in CIA. In those days, CIA, you know, public profile was virtually non-existent. So, I mean, really, that's all it was. And, you know, the story continued for the next 34 years.
Well, and that story went from you taking a leap of faith and joining the CIA to playing a key role in some of the biggest controversies there. You've been getting attention since your book came out, Company Man. The idea that you were maybe the man who could have stopped the so-called enhanced interrogation techniques, including waterboarding, before they happened. How did you first hear about these methods?
It was in the early months of 2002, late March, first part of April 2002, which was, you know, just a few months after the 9/11 attacks. What had happened is that the CIA had captured its first really high-level big fish, so to speak, of the Al-Qaeda hierarchy, a man named Abu Zubaydah, who, as is an oversimplification, but he was basically the travel agent for Al-Qaeda and its terrorists. And he was captured. He was taken. He was the first resident, so to speak, of the CIA newly constructed the black site, constructed after 9/11. And the consensus of all of our intelligence experts was that if someone were to know in Al-Qaeda about the next attack coming against the homeland, and, you know, if you can go back in time, Rob, remember that everyone in the country assumed that it wasn't a question of if, but when the next attack would come, that this guy, Abu Zubaydah, would know about it. And shortly after being taken into custody, and he was shot up fairly significantly in the takedown. But after he recovered with the help of CIA doctors, he began to talk, but also made it quite clear to his interrogators, FBI and CIA interrogators, that there were things that he knew that the U.S. government wanted to know, and he simply was not going to tell us, and we couldn't make him. So it was decided that a new set of measures, extraordinary, unprecedented measures, needed to be considered to change the equation, so to speak, and try to get him to talk. I just know there's finally that the context of the time is terribly important here, in that this was a few months after 9/11, and the pressure, the fact that time was deemed to be of the essence, was pervasive everywhere. So that's why the agency counterterrorism group came up with these proposed set of procedures, and they came to me as the chief legal advisor before going anywhere else to brief me on what they had in mind. None of which, by the way, all of which, by the way, was unprecedented to me. I had never heard of waterboarding in my 25 years prior to CIA had never done anything close to what was being proposed. So it's true, and I made clear in the book that I could have more or less stopped the whole idea before it started.
Well, waterboarding was one of a handful of things on the list. It ultimately became one of the most controversial things on the list. Do you think now that waterboarding is a form of torture?
No. No, at the time, mercifully, in my 25 years, I never had to become conversant with the torture statute, which is a law that's been on the books for a long time in the United States Code. I didn't know when I first heard these about what our people were contemplating. I honestly did not know where the legal line on the torture statute was, but certainly some of these procedures, particularly waterboarding, struck me as wherever the line was, this kind of thing was close to it. So that was the sort of the conundrum I faced. I was in uncharted waters legally, so to speak.
Well, one critic of waterboarding was John McCain, then senator, then presidential candidate. In the 2008 primaries, he made the case that after World War II, Japanese soldiers were charged with war crimes because of torture. On the lists of charges, waterboarding. Should we hold ourselves to a similar standard that was applied then?
Well, I don't dispute that we should vary from the existing history or practices, and certainly I and no one at CIA ever had any quarrel with Senator McCain's position on that. And Lord knows he had more of a right to take that position than anyone else, certainly more than I had. But the fact of the matter was those practices, the euphemism waterboarding, over time, was far different than the sort of procedure that our people were contemplating. I mean, I don't want to gainsay the fact that waterboarding, by any measure, is an extremely aggressive technique. But the way CIA was to administer it and did administer it really was miles apart from anything the Japanese had done or later the Khmer Rouge had done under the rubric of waterboarding. So the program, the agency posed and put into place was far different and far more regulated and controlled than any of the kinds of waterboarding that had occurred before.
We're talking to John Rizzo. He spent 34 years as a lawyer at the CIA, 7 of those years as the CIA's chief legal officer. His new book is Company Man, 30 Years of Controversy and Crisis in the CIA.
Now is the news, and then we'll be back with more from John Rizzo. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're back now with longtime CIA lawyer John Rizzo. His new book is Company Man, and we're talking about his career at the CIA and the controversies he dealt with there. John, just before the news, we were talking about enhanced interrogation techniques. Ultimately, you gave the green light, at least as it regarded your job, to waterboarding, sleep deprivation, other techniques. There was another that you didn't. I gather you can't specify it. But what led to one proposed technique not getting the okay?
Unfortunately, Rob, you know, as any CIA, former CIA employee, before writing anything, a book or an article, I was required to submit to the agency my manuscript for pre-publication review. And that particular technique, I was not able to delineate in detail. I did refer to it in the book as a technique so gruesome that ultimately so gruesome that we in the Justice Department ultimately decided to drop it from the list of proposed techniques. So I'm a bit constrained in that regard, but all I can tell you is that it was our expert deemed it to be one of the techniques that would be extremely helpful in getting Mr. Zubeda to talk. But honestly, both I and the Justice Department who were considering these techniques ultimately decided to pull it because it was even more aggressive and more brutal than even the waterboard.
And was it your thinking that would have crossed the line and violated laws regarding torture, whereas these other techniques did not?
Well, I was ultimately deferring to the Department of Justice, which is the ultimate legal authority for all interpretation of all federal statutes. They had indicated to me that this particular technique may have crossed the line. They didn't come to a final decision, but we collectively decided, out of a sense of prudence, to just drop it.
Do you think we're ultimately safer for using the enhanced interrogation techniques, including waterboarding?
I do. Of course, I realize all the debate and controversy that has ensued over these many years now since the program was started and ultimately ended in the beginning of 2009. I do think they played an important role in the collection of otherwise unavailable intelligence in the and particularly in the first few years after 9/11. Now, how much, how big a role they played, and more specifically, whether the same information could have been obtained by from Zubaydah and the subsequent CIA detainees who were subjected to techniques, whether that would have happened without having to resort to these admittedly aggressive measures, I think that's ultimately unknowable. But again, I just, if you permit me, just hark back to the fact that at the time this program was conceived and conducted, you know, time was considered by everyone in Washington and I think around the country to be of the essence. We all thought and feared and dreaded that another attack was imminent.
Do you have any, in hindsight, qualms or regrets about decisions that you or others around you made in these interrogation methods?
Well, Rob, I mean, I have given that a lot of thought in the years subsequent to that, to all of these events, and that's one of the things I wanted to lay out in the book. You know, in all honesty, I don't have any qualms. I mean, I just have to put myself back in time to 2002. From a 2014 perspective, you know, there's not been mercifully another major attack in the homeland. Osama bin Laden has been found and eliminated. I mean, that's all, of course, all to the good and a blessed thing. But putting myself back into that period of time, into that period of crisis, I honestly, even now, knowing all that transpired in the years since, I honestly can't say that I could have and would have made a different decision. It was a very vexing and difficult decision, but I do not regret it.
You mentioned earlier the CIA black sites where people were interrogated, and you actually visited one a few years later, moving the story ahead a little bit. What were those black sites like?
Yes, well, I actually visited two. The description I give in the book is a composite. The CIA black site would change from year to year. It would be moved to different parts of the world. I visited two of them in roughly the 2004-2005 time period. They, each of them, albeit in, you know, vastly different geographical locations, were primarily the same. I toured them, and the best analogy I would make is that it was tantamount and conducted similar to what a U.S. federal prison facility, maximum security, would have been conducted, save for the fact, of course, that it was a secret facility in which no one outside of CIA would be permitted. But the facilities themselves were clean, well run. The cells were like, actually, according to specifically U.S. federal prison of U.S. federal prison standards.
You write that there's been a fundamental change in the way the U.S. pursues terrorists, from attempting to capture people and then interrogate them to killing them. Drone strikes, special operations attacks in the case of Osama bin Laden. What do you make of that change?
Well, you know, that change was made by executive order by President Obama just literally 2 days after he took office. Now, recall that in the campaign of 2008, both candidates, John McCain and Barack Obama, had made it clear that they were going to eliminate the CIA prison system and rescind the enhanced interrogation program as soon as being elected. So it was, you know, it was certainly no surprise to CIA when President Obama did that shortly after taking office. But, you know, as everyone knows, what the Obama administration did do was not only continue but step up and double down significantly on the number of drone strikes directed against terrorists. And you know, my own view is that it was fundamentally contingent on and related to the decision the Obama administration made was to eliminate the CIA secret prison program and its program in general to capture, detain, and aggressively interrogate terrorists. I mean, I think there's just a logical and undeniable nexus between those two policy decisions.
Before I let you go, in popular culture and I think popular conversation, there's a view that, you know, the CIA is always doing these secret things. They're kidnapping people or torturing them. These are just the things we happen to find out about. Do you, from reading your book, I assume you'll contest that popular notion of the CIA?
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of popular notions about CIA that, you know, that have grown over the years, you know, based on spy novels and spy movies. As I indicated earlier, Rob, when 9/11 happened, I had been a lawyer at CIA for 25 years. Never before 9/11 had CIA ever built secret prisons, detained terrorists, subjected them to, you know, admittedly harsh interrogation techniques. That was a new point of departure for the agency. It was a new point of departure, certainly for me. And I would suggest that listeners should not generalize from those actions after 2011 and assume that CIA had always and will always do these sorts of things. That was an extraordinary, unprecedented period that I don't believe will ever be repeated.
John, thanks a lot for spending time with us today.
I appreciate your inviting me, Rob. Thank you.
That's John Rizzo, formerly with the CIA. His new book is called Company Man, 30 Years of Controversy and Crisis in the CIA. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, our guest says it's time to reclaim girlhood from the stereotypes and sexualization that surround it.
But first, we're joined by Noah Ovshinsky. He joins us every Friday to check in on what's happening in Wisconsin news.
Hi, Noah.
Hey, good afternoon.
So big news for the UW. There's been a search for a new president of the UW system. What's the final word?
So, yeah, UW Colleges and Extension Chancellor Ray Cross was appointed this week as the next president of the UW system. So as it turns out, the system and the regents in particular didn't have to look too far for their successful candidate.
Tell us a little bit about why Ray Cross got chosen.
Right. So actually, Ray Cross is the third, I believe, internal candidate in a row to become president of the system. And I think there are a few reasons based on what he's done in his job that he's just now leaving, as well as the relationships that he's had. One, I think Ray Cross has an enormous amount of credibility within the system because one of his big initiatives was the Flex option, which is an online degree program essentially aimed at working adults. This is a program that has been talked about by the governor and others quite positively in the last several months. So I think he got a lot of credit for that. You know, Ray Cross also knows the UW system. You know, regents have said that, you know, they feel that this is a very complex organization. It's a big budget. It's a lot of people. And that it was important to appoint someone who knows it well. And so I think that's the second reason. You know, another reason I'd say is Ray Cross has very good relationships with the governor, key legislators, the regents themselves, and he has a very good reputation on campus. And I think all of those things will be important as he takes over this very big job.
To spin off that last point of yours, now there had been some friction between the UW and the legislature around issues of transparency. Is there any indication about how Ray Cross might function as a liaison between the UW system and the state government?
Right. So last year, there there's quite a bit of controversy raised by key members of the legislature who took issue with the university's reserves, their cash reserves that the university had. This was at a time when the university was raising tuition, and it was quite a controversy, and one that lawmakers said was partly rooted, at least, in a lack of transparency that they felt existed between certainly lawmakers and administration at the UW system. Ray Cross has basically said that transparency will be one of the really one of his top priorities. He said, you know, one of his priorities will be simplifying the university financial reporting structure. He said, you know, it's got to be clear. And basically, you know, you shouldn't have to be a CPA. You shouldn't have to be an accountant to understand sort of the basic finances of the university system. And of course, that was one of the issues with these cash reserves and why they came as such a surprise to legislators. So I think for Ray Cross, part of that transparency is making sure that the finances are easy to understand, both for lawmakers and for members of the public.
And what about in terms of goals and initiatives that he might be interested? What's at the top of his list?
Yeah, other than that, you know, really that transparency issue, I'd say two other things he mentioned, I should say, during a press conference this morning. And this was sort of his first event with the media since being appointed as president. And he identified really there are two challenges, actually, more than anything else. And he said one is he wants to help students who really are facing an increasing cost of education. He wants to make sure he keeps and the system itself keeps tuition down. It keeps student debt down. And the second challenge he talked about, in addition to the affordability issue, is compensation levels for faculty and staff. He said that absolutely must be addressed to ensure that the university stays competitive on the job market.
Any word on when he starts?
I believe it's mid-February. I think February 15th he's looking to start.
Okay. Well, in news from the Assembly, we have some movement on a few bills aimed at addressing the heroin problem in Wisconsin. And before we get to the particulars of that, where did the impetus for these bills come from?
I would say that, you know, heroin is a huge issue in Wisconsin and growing. And whether or not people in the community know or have been directly affected by heroin addiction, this is something that is having a really effect both on law enforcement and families. And here the legislature is picking up and trying to do something to stop what I think can only be described at this point as an epidemic. So the State Assembly moved out of committee this week three bills that really address this growing problem. They were sponsored by Representative John Nygren, whose daughter actually overdosed a few years ago on heroin. She did survive. But this is obviously an issue for him that cuts very close to home.
And getting to that first bill, this one's being called a Good Samaritan Law. What does it address?
Right. So one of the bills actually creates what's called a Good Samaritan Law in Wisconsin. And basically what it does is it grants immunity to anyone who calls 911, you know, to report an overdose. Or it grants immunity to people who might drop somebody off at the ER if they're overdosing. And, you know, people who work with addicts say, you know, it's this fear of really this prosecution that prevents people from picking up that phone or getting in the car, and that this would be really helpful. The second bill deals with Narcan, which is a drug that can essentially reverse the effects of an overdose. And it's a lifesaver for somebody who's overdosing on heroin and other opiate drugs.
And it kind of needs to be there in the moment of truth, right?
Right, exactly. So what this bill does is it requires all emergency level technicians to carry what we call Narcan. And this bill also allows police and firefighters to administer the drug. Right now, you know, only paramedics that have more sort of advanced training can carry the drug. There aren't that many that do. And so, again, this is something that people who work with addicts and, of course, families would love to see happen. I mean, this is a drug that saves lives, but right now it's not widely available. So this drug basically is what can save lives, including John Nygren's daughter's life. This drug was administered and proved to be incredibly helpful. So this bill would essentially make the availability of this drug, it would make it much more wide.
And the third bill, now this one deals with prescription drug disposal programs. How does that figure in with the heroin problem?
Yeah, and this is simply it allows municipalities to run prescription drug disposal programs. Prescription drugs are one of the things law enforcement looks at, really the gateway. You know, some people start their addiction with legal painkillers, and when they either don't get them high anymore or they don't have access to those painkillers anymore, people move on to heroin and other similar drugs. So it's kind of like the gateway drug. And so one of the things the state is trying to do, law enforcement's trying to do, is to crack down on prescription drugs. And interestingly enough, Shemaine Mills just reported this week about the prescription drug monitoring program, which is essentially a database where pharmacists, doctors, and law enforcement can look and see, you know, who's getting prescriptions for these drugs. It's supposed to minimize what we call, pharmacy shopping. Shemaine found, interestingly enough, that law enforcement really hasn't used this database very much because they've been so busy prosecuting heroin cases. This is in Eau Claire, Appleton, other cities in the state. So, I mean, they're so busy with dealing with heroin that they haven't had time to really utilize this database that supposedly would help them get to the root of this addiction.
This could be something helpful in the toolkit then.
It is. But, you know, they're just so busy with these heroin investigations that they don't have time.
Well, rounding things up today is the news of a leaked DNR report on the health and environmental risks associated with mining. What happened?
Right. So this report was just leaked, or I should say it was just published yesterday by Media Trackers, which is a conservative website. The organization obtained a copy. And what this was an internal DNR report that's sort of been circulating around the agency for a while. And basically what it does is it's a review of the scientific literature that's out there that more or less evaluates or deals with the risks associated with the kind of mining that's being proposed in the Pinoki Hills in northern Wisconsin. And it identifies several issues, effects on groundwater, the release of material that is what's described as asbestos-like material. And so this was – the release of this report was very controversial because obviously it feeds the fire to people who are against the mine. GTEC officials, the company who wants to build this mine, you know, they told the Wisconsin State Journal that they felt that some in the DNR, they use this report as proof that those in the DNR, there are some in the DNR that are biased against mining, and that the report was prepared before the company even had a chance to finish sampling, which is supposed to reveal, you know, potential environmental problems.
That seems to be the sticking point here, when exactly this report was compiled that GTEC is taking issue with.
Exactly. The DNR defended the report, saying, you know, that it's objective. It doesn't come down on one side or the other. It's not pro-mining or anti-mining. And they say, you know, this isn't part of the mining permit process itself, that the agency essentially says that the real work of evaluating this, the environmental impact of this proposed mine, really begins when they start working on the environmental impact study, which hasn't happened yet. GTEC hasn't applied to officially mine yet. They're only sampling at this point. So the DNR says it's very early in the process, and you know, this report wasn't meant to take the place of an environmental impact study.
So what do you think this will mean for the DNR and its relationship with GTEC going forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at the mining issue itself over the course of the last 2-3 years, I mean, it's certainly another chapter in what is a very controversial issue. But I'll say, I think at the very least, it really complicates the relationship between the DNR and GTEC. And obviously, there's going to have to be a lot of cooperation there if a mine is going to be built. And I think this sort of muddies the waters to some extent, because of how GTEC has responded to the report and how the DNR has responded to its release.
Well, Noah, as always, thank you so much for joining us.
It was good to be here. Thanks.
Noah Ovshinsky is our news guy, making his weekly appearance, running up the news. And by the way, the new UW system president, Ray Cross, it looks like will be joining us on Tuesday afternoon to take a look ahead at his priorities.
Coming up, our guest is an advocate for reclaiming girlhood from the stereotypes that surround it. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.